It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This week, Milwaukee public schools are proposing a $1.6 billion budget for the next school year.
The budget is meant to address the district's deficit of $46 million, while also adding a number of new classroom positions.
At the same time, the budget would reduce district administration and assistant principal staffing.
MPS officials are presenting their new budget to the school board later today, with a vote planned later this month.
Brenda Caselius is superintendent for Milwaukee Public Schools. Superintendent Caselius, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
In the release on this budget, the press release, it describes this as an inflection point with the budget guiding its next steps. Big picture, what course do you see this budget proposal setting the district on for the future?
Well, you know, when I got here about a year ago, we had a pretty desperate situation with our fiscal office. And so we had to get that in order by finishing our three audits and then get clear sight of where we were at. In January, we saw that we had a pretty big deficit. And, you know, part of this work is getting that in order to move forward and pivot to the academic programming and get our kids what they need.
One of the tough choices described in the budget proposal, reducing over 100 staff positions, including assistant principals and administrative staff. Why look there for those cuts?
Well, you know, and part of our audits, the governor did an operational audit, and we did an HR audit, and we had our academic audit. So several audits that we did just on programming and operations showed that we were a little bit heavy on our operations side and at a central office, and a little light on the classroom side. So we wanted to get resources closest to our students and give them a fighting chance at getting the resources that they need to succeed and thrive in school and learn to read. As you know, Milwaukee public school students have a pretty low reading rate and grade level by grade four as assessed on the National Assessment for Educational Progress. And we want to do better by our students and get them reading on grade level. And this is part of that effort.
One of the goals is getting some more people in classroom positions. What kind of additions are you doing there?
Well, it's your teachers of record. They're the teachers who are right in front of our students, who give them the personalized attention that they need. As you know, we shifted to an academic literacy plan to comply with Act 10 within the science of reading. We got one of the best specialists across the nation to work with us on our literacy and to work with our amazing teachers. And we're really excited about these shifts to the classroom. And that is where we're headed over the next school year.
The teachers union, among others, have raised concerns that there are already challenges in filling existing in-classroom positions. Are you going to be able to fill these new slots?
Well, I think so. And we definitely want to ensure that we have a permanent, caring, licensed teacher in every single classroom. And we think that we have very competitive benefits and salary that will be wonderful for our employees. And it's a great place to work. Our teachers are very dedicated and committed to our students. And we hope that people will give Milwaukee Public Schools a look. And we have a year-round staffing strategy now that we're using to recruit and retain the best talent in Wisconsin.
The budget proposal offers a 2.63% cost of living pay raise for employees. A concern raised by teachers again here is that that doesn't come all at once. About half of it is delayed for later. They're saying, hey, this is going to cost us money by not implementing the full thing at once. Why that decision to stagger that cost of living increase?
Well, you know, we have this $50 million deficit and there's just no good solutions, you know. And I think one of the very hardest things I've had to do in my career was to reduce positions at the district level this past January, with 264 positions for the next school year being reduced. That was a very difficult decision to make. We have valued, dedicated employees who did great work with our students. We think all of them, or many of them, will be able to move into other positions within the district where those vacancies exist. And so it gives us great hope that they'll continue to work with Milwaukee Public Schools and will attract even new talent to the district.
We're talking about a new $1.6 billion budget proposal for Milwaukee K-12 schools with MPS Superintendent Brenda Caselius. Long-term, Superintendent Casellius, Milwaukee is dealing with a problem shared by small communities around the state, declining enrollment. Part of that is just because of demographics, changes in birth numbers in the state, also voucher schools drawing off some students. How do you see Milwaukee Public Schools adapting to that reality of lower enrollment?
Yeah, so, you know, that's been a struggle, not just for Milwaukee or Wisconsin. It's really a struggle across the nation that we're seeing these birth rates going down. And that means that you have a lot more underutilized buildings to have to cover the costs for. And then that makes it really challenging to staff as well and use your staff efficiently within the schools. So this is a struggle, not just in Milwaukee, but really across the nation. And then, of course, Milwaukee and all of Wisconsin has the choice options for parents to be able to choose their schooling for their children, and that creates a competitive environment. The fortunate thing for Milwaukee is that we have 60,000 students who are choosing other schools other than Milwaukee Public Schools. So that gives us at least some students in which to compete. And so we think that Milwaukee Public Schools have some of the best schools in Wisconsin, some of the best programming with our International Baccalaureate programming, our Montessori programming, our Career and Pathway programming, NAF certification for students to go right back into careers with a certificate, and just really incredible arts programming throughout that our taxpayers have provided referenda for our students. So some really wonderful reasons why our families should choose Milwaukee Public Schools, and we plan on competing and having quality schools across the entire city of Milwaukee and some of our suburban districts who want to open enroll.
That said, there's been talk of closing some of Milwaukee's schools, including a consultant pointing toward closing some schools in predominantly Black neighborhoods, which received community pushback, of course. What are you looking at in evaluating the decision of whether some school buildings might need to close?
Well, I've been very transparent with our public since I started the superintendency here that we just have too much inventory in terms of our buildings. Plus, our buildings are about 85 years in age, and the average age of building across the nation is about 45 years. So we're getting to the, you know, end of life for many of our buildings. You know, replacing the boilers and the roofs costs a lot of money. So there's a lot of deferred maintenance in our schools, and just closing that inventory will save the district money over the next decade, and being able to reinvest that back right into the community, repurpose those buildings into affordable housing or other multi civic use. And, you know, I think that's a wonderful benefit to the community, and also can save us money and help us to better utilize our staffing within our other schools and maximize the support systems that we are able to provide children.
Now, big news in the year before you came on board at MPS, the DPI threatening to withhold millions from the school because the district wasn't reporting financial information, required financial information to the state. Is that problem fixed now?
That is absolutely fixed. And we were able to complete three fiscal audits. And, you know, there were some findings within those audits. So we've been able to reestablish the control environment, provide the additional personnel that we needed to provide and training. Within that, our accounting side of the house is doing really well. It's the budget side that we're working on right now to put in place those controls, to control for overspending, to make sure that we're working within our means and responsible budgets. We have to be good stewards of the public's trust, and that's what we're trying to do in restoring the fiscal health of the organization and of the school district this year, so that our taxpayers and the public knows that our fiscal house is in order and we have reestablished all of those controls.
Right. The district passed a referendum just a couple years ago by a pretty narrow margin. We had the failure to meet reporting standards. A lot of stakeholders, I think, whether we're talking state lawmakers, local residents who are paying taxes here, might have lost faith in the district's ability to perform as a steward of the financial resources provided to the schools. What do you say to those stakeholders to say, yes, you can trust us?
Well, I've been working hard over the past year with the staff at the district to be able to redemonstrate and to rebuild trust with the public around our fiscal house. And I think that with our release of this budget, they're going to see the fiscal prudence within the district. They're going to see us making the tough decisions. Our board has been tremendously supportive of that and understanding the gravity of the nature of the position that the district was in and the cleanup that we've done over this past year. And so I'm very proud of the team for really rallying. I'm proud of this board for making the courageous decisions. And I'm grateful to our employees who have made sacrifices so that we could be fiscally sound into not only this year, but into years coming, so that the cuts that will have to happen in the future years, and if the state doesn't continue to give us additional revenue to the students within the entire state of Wisconsin, I believe that we are going to be in a tough fiscal position, but because of the decisions we're making in this budget, it will not be as tough as it would have been in the coming years.
In our last few moments, there have been a lot of challenges, the budget, lead remediation, and more. But where do you see the biggest opportunities for improvement for the district in the year after this new budget gets passed?
Well, certainly I'm very excited to begin this pivot from cleaning up the district and the district's finances and some of the operations, particularly in our HR department, and two, and making sure that we're hiring. So I would say getting that permanent licensed caring teacher in every single classroom is one of my top goals and has been a top goal because that is the heart of the work. We already have some incredibly dedicated individuals and some of the best teachers in all of Wisconsin and the nation. And I'm just very proud of this district. And as we pivot and turn this corner, we're going to be focusing on students, our welcoming and safe environments, as well as making sure that they have the academic rigor that they need to read on grade level and succeed in life. And so just feeling really hopeful about the future for Milwaukee Public Schools as we pivot from this budget into next year, focusing on children, lowering our class sizes, adding additional teachers and paraprofessionals so that our students are supported, and really protecting those direct services to our students like physical education, music, art, PE, and some of our award-winning programs.
And we'll leave it there. That's Superintendent Brenda Caselius with the Milwaukee Public School District.
Coming up, the State Justice Department must now release the names of all the state's law enforcement officers as part of a police accountability project. Here are two sides on the issue.
I think that if you are a law enforcement officer, your identity should be known and knowable.
People can misuse the information. I think it increases the potential for identity theft or doxing.
That's next on WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. Last week, a Dane County judge ordered the Wisconsin Department of Justice to release the names of all of the certified law enforcement officers working in the state. Advocates hailing that decision as a win for police accountability.
The ruling from April 28th sided with the Badger Project and the Illinois-based Invisible Institute. It filed a lawsuit to release the names in 2024 to better track officers who are fired or forced to leave a job and then are hired elsewhere.
The information released would also include badge numbers, employment history, and dates of birth.
Police associations have pushed back on the ruling, saying releasing the list would constitute safety and privacy violations for officers. And we'll hear more of those concerns shortly.
First, Bill Leaders is with us, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. He's editor-at-large of the Progressive magazine and a writer based in Madison. He's supported this list being released. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Now, the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council has come out in support of the lawsuit, the recent ruling. What do you see at stake in this lawsuit?
Well, the lawsuit is over the refusal of the Department of Justice to release the names of all law enforcement officers in Wisconsin, which was sought by the Badger Project as part of its reporting on officers who get fired in one department and get rehired in another. They've done a lot of reporting on that, and so they need the names of officers and ways to identify them in order to do that type of research and reporting. But when the DOJ said no, the Badger Project sued along with the Invisible Institute, which is a Chicago-based organization. And this week, on last week, I should say, on August 28th, a Dane County judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and ordered the Department of Justice to release the names that were requested.
Right. And why are you in favor of this? I know you are an advocate for transparency in government. With this particular issue, why do you see this being important?
Well, first and foremost, I don't think that Wisconsin should have secret police. I think that if you are a law enforcement officer, your identity should be known and knowable. I mean, we've seen that come up with the masking of federal agents, where that cuts against good public policy to have people be anonymous. In this case, it's different, but there is a legitimate purpose that is served by having access to the information of who is a law enforcement officer in Wisconsin. And the Department of Justice, as I understand it, did not identify any actual past problems with officers being identified. It just speculated that there was something bad about identifying who all the law enforcement officers are, particularly officers who work undercover. And so you're not going to get that record.
One concern is, okay, yes, police officers have always been concerned maybe about being targeted or retaliated against by the public. But now on a database, with the internet being what it is, with the ease, if you have all this information in one place, of someone being able to harass basically every officer in the state at once, does this change in our modern technology warrant, hey, maybe making it a little less transparent, a little less accessible for the officers who are serving the public here?
I don't think so. There's 30 states that routinely make this information public. Wisconsin is one of just about a dozen that has not provided this information. There is not a pattern of harassment that has been documented in other states that allow the identity of officers. Harassing an officer is a pretty serious offense. You can get in trouble for it. And people aren't just looking up lists in order to rail at officers because they can.
As a general principle, people may not think about government transparency a lot, right? You don't run into it across in your daily life. Why is it something that you think the public should have their attention on, have their minds on?
Okay, going back to the original purpose of the request, it was to have a database of those who are law enforcement officers in Wisconsin so that you could check to see if the law enforcement officers in Wisconsin were previously fired as law enforcement officers in Cleveland or Seattle or Dallas or somewhere else and then got hired here. You can't do that research without knowing the names of the officers who work here.
Do you see a difference if the ultimate resolution here is, hey, this is a public database, I could go online right now and look up the name and badge number and everything of every officer in the state, versus it's not there publicly, but by a request, by a specific request from a journalistic outfit or a citizen, then, hey, yes, we'll release that information to you on a case-by-case basis. Would that second, more limited outcome, if through the courts it came out to something like that, be okay? Would that be enough transparency?
I don't believe anyone has suggested that particular solution. And I don't know that there's anything that's been demonstrably wrong about identifying who law enforcement officers are. The best argument that they have deals with officers who are working undercover. But in point of fact, officers that are working undercover are not using their real names. So having access to a database that shows someone as an officer is not going to get you any closer to identify the undercover people.
This is one court ruling. We'll see in the future if this gets appealed up the legal ladder here. What would your message be to Attorney General Call and the Department of Justice to not keep challenging it and to just go with this and start providing this information?
Well, it's important to note that the Department of Justice made the determination on receipt of the request that it wanted to provide this information to the requester. It made that as an affirmative decision. And then it started hearing from police departments around the state saying, nah, we don't like this, don't do it. And so the DOJ changed its mind and said, no, you're not, you can't have it now. And so that's what started off the lawsuit. Yes, it will be appealed. I have a feeling that the higher courts are going to sustain the ruling of the lower courts, because transparency is a pretty important value for the state of Wisconsin, and the judicial system tends to side with the idea that the public should have a maximum amount of information about the affairs of government.
Bill, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure. Thank you, Rob.
That's Bill Leaders, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. He's editor-at-large of The Progressive magazine and a writer based in Madison. His organization has come out in support of the lawsuit to release the names of Wisconsin's law enforcement officers. While some advocacy groups have supported that effort to release those names, police groups have pushed back. Jim Palmer is executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, is with us now. Jim, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
What are your concerns with this ruling?
Well, what the Dane County Circuit Court did here last week, it issued an order that the Department of Justice, State Department of Justice, has to release a statewide data set of more than 16,000 current and former law enforcement officers, including their names, dates of birth, and employment histories. And that information is expected to be used to build a publicly searchable database, potentially as part of a broader national effort. And so, you know, the goal behind it is understandable. I mean, the idea is to try and track so-called wandering cops. Our concern as the state's largest law enforcement group is really more about, you know, whether this approach actually works and whether it creates new risks in the process.
Well, let's talk about those risks you're worried about, first of all.
The risk for us is anytime you take all this information and put it together and aggregate it with other information that's, you know, searchable, I think you increase the likelihood and the risks that, people can misuse the information. I think it increases the potential for identity theft or doxing. And that's, I think, a valid concern for a lot of individuals, especially those that, you know, are working their communities to try and, keep their communities safe. It's just I think it makes a lot of people apprehensive who work in law enforcement. And I think it's to be clear, this isn't about avoiding transparency. We have a long history of advocating for measures to increase transparency and accountability. It's about really whether or not this type of thing will work. And, you know, again, whether it creates new risks in the process. You know, I think dates of birth typically are, you know, items of information that are redacted in most records requests. You know, employment histories of officers, that's not the same as misconduct history. And I think that could lead people to draw conclusions that aren't fair and are misleading. And, those are some of the concerns that we have.
The argument, I think, from supporters of this and those who brought the lawsuit is, hey, our needs for transparency and accountability and to be able to track officers, and you mentioned that the so-called wandering officer issue, we can't really do these things without this kind of access to information in, they would say, ideally every state. Is that true, do you think? Are there ways to do these things, that these accountability measures, without having this kind of information accessible?
I think so. I mean, Wisconsin already has a lot of, it already has a decertification process, a certification process. There are ways to track misconduct. I think, it would be better to, explore ways to improve those government, run measures than some kind of private database, which just isn't going to, have the same protections for the men and women who police our communities.
A couple dozen states, including, I believe, Minnesota and Illinois, have released something like this to nationwide reporting projects. Have you seen anything in those cases that you see abuse of these systems so far?
Not that we're aware of yet, but I think it's important to note a few things. First, the absence of evidence is not evidence in and of itself, okay? I think, crimes like identity theft and things of that nature are tend to be investigated at the local level. They're not tracked or, reported anywhere that we're aware of. And so I think that's a little misleading for anyone to assert that, other states have done something similar some of these problems haven't come up. The other point I think that is really worth mentioning is that the data set involved in the Wisconsin case includes dates of birth, and that is simply not the case in other states. So I think that these private organizations that are pushing to build this database on a national scale, are being a little misleading. They're very careful with their words, but the fact of the matter is the information is different. And I think to try and assert that, well, you know, these problems haven't arisen elsewhere, so they won't arise here is also misleading.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jim Palmer is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Earlier, we heard from Bill Leaders, President of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, which came out in support of the ruling, ordering the release of the names and other information of Wisconsin's law enforcement officers.
Coming up, the national radio program The Middle is coming to Kenosha for a community discussion on veterans' mental health. Get a preview.
I think one of the hardest things for veterans is to finally realize that it's time to ask for help. That is by far the hardest hurdle I have come to.
A view on veterans' mental health in Wisconsin. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Anxiety and depression are on the rise around the country, and military veterans face higher risks of developing a mental health disorder.
How can communities better support the mental health of veterans as they navigate life after service?
That's the question at the heart of an upcoming public event in Kenosha.
Jeremy Hobson, host of the national call-in radio show The Middle, is hosting a live taping of the show on Tuesday, May 12th. It will be held at the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. It's called The Battle at Home, Addressing Veterans' Mental Health.
Later, we'll hear from one of the event's speakers, a combat veteran who served in Kuwait and Iraq and now lives in Waupaca.
But first, Jeremy Hobson joins us, host of The Middle, which airs on WPR News and WUWM Thursday evenings at 8. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Kate.
What sparked the idea to do a live show about veterans' mental health in Kenosha?
So, you know, in the last couple of years of doing The Middle, we have taken the show on the road. I think it's at least 15 states at this point. And we had been in conversation with the folks at the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in Kenosha and talked about what kind of show we could do from there as we sort of ramp up our live broadcasts around the country ahead of the midterm elections. And we settled on this idea because it is such an important issue, and it's such a shocking thing that the number one cause of death for active duty military is suicide, and the second highest cause of death for veterans under the age of 45 is also suicide. So we decided we wanted to do a show where we could hear from people about what's going on and what needs to be done.
And I think about how your show is really aimed at elevating voices of people in the middle, and that can be geography, that can be here in the Midwest, it can be political beliefs, worldview. Is there a way to find some middle common ground on veterans' mental health?
You know, I think one of the interesting things about some of the topics that we have done on The Middle is you find things where there isn't a political divide like there is on, let's say, you know, immigration or abortion or taxation. There are some things that when people actually start to talk and think about it, they realize they have a lot more in common than what divides them. And so we're going to find out, you know, how people think about this and whether there is a political divide about what should be done about, you know, mental health among veterans and among active duty military personnel.
What do you think these conversations in Wisconsin can help to illuminate about veterans' mental health? You know, how do you think your show can bring more to this topic?
Well, one of the things that we have tried to do and we will be doing here in Wisconsin is bringing the voices of people in the state, to the entire country, because The Middle now airs on almost 500 stations around the United States, as well as our podcast, which for the first time is on the charts, Kate. We are in the top 100 podcasts on Spotify right now, which is awesome. Yeah. So you're going to have a big audience that's hearing the voices of people in Wisconsin. And we've assembled an amazing panel. We've got Laura Colbert, who I know you're going to be speaking with in a moment, a veteran of the Iraq War, a member of the Wisconsin Board of Veterans Affairs, and also Bob Curry, who's a Vietnam vet and founded this organization called Dry Hooch, which is a peer support organization for veterans and their families. So we're going to be bringing these voices of people in Wisconsin to the rest of the country in a way that, you know, if you look at the rest of the mass media in this country, and this is part of the reason we do this show, is you don't often hear from people in the middle of the country on these big, important issues.
What do you think is so valuable about the act of meeting in the middle?
Meeting in the middle, I think the democracy in this country does not work if we don't talk and listen to one another. So that is hugely important. But I think the other thing that's valuable is if you think about our elections, where are they decided? They're decided in places like Wisconsin and Michigan, places in the middle of the country that don't get as much attention as places like New York and Washington, D.C. in our national media. And I think it's very important to have a conversation that includes people in these critical states ahead of elections and just all of the time.
Jeremy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Jeremy Hobson, host of the radio program The Middle, which airs on WPR News every Thursday at 8 o'clock. He was with us to talk about his upcoming live show in Kenosha called The Battle at Home, addressing veteran mental health. Now we'll hear from one of the guest speakers who will be featured at the event. Laura Colbert is Parks and Recreation Director for the city of Waupaca. Previously, she served as a military police officer in the Army National Guard in Kuwait and Iraq. Laura, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
This event in Kenosha is called The Battle at Home. What was your biggest challenge as you returned to civilian life after serving in Kuwait and Iraq?
I think it was getting back into the civilian mind frame and feeling like I was a part of my everyday life again. I had a really hard time relating to fellow college folk because I was going to school at UW-Madison. And one of the things that really struck me is they were worried about what to wear at the next party. And I had just gotten shot at for the last 16 months. So how could I bridge that gap? How could I reintegrate into society? And one of the things I started doing was giving presentations about my experience, which was not only therapeutic for me, but it also opened everybody's eyes to what war was like for us in Iraq, because it was still a very new war at the time. And honestly, the mental health side of things for the first 2 years was a very large struggle for me, because I always consider myself somebody who had a really strong will, strong brain. I was able to overcome hurdles. And the fact that I actually had to reach out and get help for my mental health was a huge milestone for me.
Where did you go? What kind of resources or support, you know, made a difference for you? Who did you go to?
Well, after a number of months of just trying to figure it out on my own, I finally called my older brother, who was also a veteran and just so happened to be in Madison. And I had pulled over outside of the Vilas Park because I couldn't drive anymore. I was so distraught. And I said, you need to take me to the VA hospital. So he came to get me and took me directly to the mental health area in the VA hospital. And they got me a therapist immediately. And her name was Amy. And I tell you, she saved my life. Like she saw me where I was at. She treated me with the utmost respect. And she helped me get back on track.
Laura, what is a myth you would like to dispel about veterans and mental health?
I think you're the first person to ever ask me that question. I think one of the hardest things for veterans, because we are trained to be tough, battle-ready individuals, is to finally realize that it's time to ask for help. That is by far the hardest hurdle I have come to. And I think that that happens a lot with a lot of veterans. My twin brother was a mental health police officer in Madison, and he said that a lot of the homeless veterans wanted to stay that way until they saw the light and were ready to ask for help. Mm-hmm. So it's something that the veterans need to come to on their own volition, as opposed to be told, this is what you need.
I'm wondering, how do you think communities like your own now in Wapaka are doing when it comes to supporting veterans? What do you see around you?
You know, it was a very interesting transition from living in Madison for over a decade to then moving back to a pretty rural area of Wisconsin. Madison, there's not a lot of support for outward support for veterans, but you come to Wapaka and on Veterans Day, every school, every organization's like, how can we support our veterans? So believe it or not, I felt more supported in Wapaka as a veteran. And there are so many other veterans here that feel the same way.
How are you doing today, may I ask?
I am doing much better. I like to say that every day that passes, I get that much closer to being my whole self. I still have some hard days. I still need to have my fellow veterans by my side to talk through things or talk to my family. There's quite a few veterans within my family. But for the most part, my post-traumatic stress has decreased substantially. There's still loud noises, still things that happen. It's an enigmatic thing in which you don't know when you will be set off when there's a trigger. And so I always just have to be prepared and kind of have a back door to go to if that happens.
Laura, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Laura Colbert, who served as a military police officer in the Army National Guard in Kuwait and Iraq, and now is Parks and Recreation Director for the city of Wapaka. Earlier, we heard from Jeremy Hobson, host of the national radio show The Middle. Jeremy is hosting a live taping of the show in Kenosha on May 12th at the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, which, for disclosure, is a business sponsor of WPR. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padezwa, Trevor Hook, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.